Sometimes when you're tired, it's a little hard maybe to engage in worship, but it is a wonderful privilege and to be able to approach the throne of God. I got to teach the book of Leviticus last quarter in Normal, and it could be so easy to get into the weeds of a book like that. But we got to start each class with a prayer. And I was trying to emphasize the fact that Leviticus is all about dwelling with God and approaching God, and that's wonderful. And it was so convenient that we already had the habit of approaching God at the beginning of each time. I hope that you're able to kind of set into that, get yourself in that posture of worship already this morning. And I want you to continue to have that posture as we continue to look at these scriptures. So just a moment, an aside. You might have expected me to say something along these lines because I'm related to the guy, but it's a bonus perk to being married to my wonderful wife, Emily, that I get to have this connection with Nathan and Jenny, but I would have been hopeful to have known him if I didn't have that connection as well. I'm excited about the partnership that you guys are working together. Nathan is not the face of this congregation. He's not the CEO of this congregation. You guys are working together, all of you, and your elders are leading the group. But I'm excited about your guys inviting him. About over a year ago, Anthony, my brother, called me or texted me or something and said, "So is Nathan coming to Illinois?" I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." Turns out Nathan didn't either. So I don't know who of you leaked. Who have you leaked that to my brother? But you guys need to tighten that up. So I had to kind of rein that in. But excited that it's worked out. And everything I said about the congregation and what you have meant to me and Emily is paralleled in the relationship that we've been able to have with Jenny and Nathan. My faith has needed them, and God has used them for me and for my family. And so I pray that you can find that blessing in their encouragement as well, and I know it'll be mutually encouraging. I know that we're all not perfect. I don't want to give the perspective that you guys are all wonderful and there's no problems, and Nathan's all wonderful and he has no problems, but I know that the Spirit is at work within you and will complete that work. All right. Psalm 11, I want to start with, because this is a sermon on Revelation 4. And so, if you would, turn over to Psalm 11. I found it's neat if there's a psalm that kind of captures the essence of a book. And I didn't think about Psalm 84, but that was wonderful too. But let's go over to Psalm 11. Maybe think about some of the scenes, the ideas in Revelation as we read. Psalm 11, it's a short psalm here. "In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, 'Flee like a bird to your mountain'? For behold, the wicked have bent the bow. They have fitted their arrow to the string to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked. Fire and sulfur and scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face." This is another one of those situations where you put the quotation marks affects how you read it a bit. But the way I read it there is taking it that someone's saying to me, "What are we going to do? The foundations are shaking. What are we going to do? Flee to the mountains?" No. The Lord's in his holy temple. That psalm, I hope, does something for you. Do you sometimes want to run for your life? You feel like the foundations that you've known and relied upon, the institutions or the people that you've relied upon, are crumbling. It's a moment when Psalm 11 is there to remind you the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. And you need that message. You need it when you feel crushed, when you feel threatened, when you have already begun to find refuge in something or someone else other than your Lord. The Lord is in his holy temple. I want to take an approach with Revelation, recognizing this is not the only time you have to be in the book, that you're going to be in the book of Revelation, or the only time you have been. And so we don't always have to do everything. We don't have to cover everything. But one of the most valuable things I find to studying a book like Revelation is to come to the text with what the readers of the text originally would have already had in their toolbox, in their familiarity. They would have already known Daniel, Ezekiel, Isaiah. They would have already known these scriptures before they came to the book of Revelation. And it is so helpful to spend time in those scriptures before you come to Revelation, and a lot of the things that feel so very difficult, there are things I don't know for sure what they mean in Revelation, but so many of the pictures are actually familiar to you when you are continually reading the Old Testament. So I want to take that approach, and I recommend that approach for other sections of Revelation. We're going to come to Revelation 4, but I recommend doing this and seeing the relevance of other things, Zechariah as well, to these other portions of the book of Revelation. But I also will say that the scene that Revelation starts with, the book never really fully departs from that scene of the Lord in his holy temple enthroned in heaven. That's a dominant picture throughout the book. All right, let's go ahead and get further into the lesson here. Enough of the Bible study tips, I suppose. The temple in the Old Testament, under the Old Covenant, was designed as a depiction of God's palace with a throne room. The Ark of the Covenant is described at times as the footstool of God. You can look over at 1 Chronicles 28:2, Psalm 132, verse 7. The footstool is a picture you can see in an actual throne. And if you would, go over to 2 Chronicles 9. I'm going to catch up here. PowerPoint. 2 Chronicles 9, verses 17 through 19. This is a throne scene, but the picture, the throne, is not God's throne, but Solomon's throne. All right. Let's see how quickly I can get to 2 Chronicles 9. All right. 2 Chronicles 9, verse 17. The king also made a great ivory throne and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had six steps and a footstool of gold which were attached to the throne. And on each side of the seat were armrests and two lions standing beside the armrests, while the 12 lions stood there, one on each end of a step on the six steps. Nothing like it was ever made for any kingdom. Now, it's speaking to the grandeur, the majesty of this particular throne. It's not that there were no thrones that had any resemblance. In fact, the ancient throne rooms typically had grandeur and typically had creatures depicted, all as a part of the throne scene. The footstool of the Ark of the temple, the Ark of the Covenant being described as a footstool, is to depict the temple as at the bottom of God's throne. And then you notice the lions here in Solomon's throne, the multiple lions flanking his throne on the approach up to his throne. And you might remember some other creatures in pictures of God's throne, and we'll see some of those as we go. The two heavenly beings on God's footstool, the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, these cherubim that reached across on the Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark was a kind of throne of Yahweh. They didn't have an idol. They weren't to have an idol of the Lord. But they had the Ark of the Covenant, which by its very nature drew your eyes and your mind upward toward heaven where God was enthroned. I'm not 100% sure about this, but in Hebrews 8, it's talking about the heavenly tabernacle. And I'll go over and read. In Hebrews 8, it talks about what Moses saw and how the tabernacle was patterned after what Moses saw. So I'm sure about all of that. The thing I'm not sure is what I'm going to suggest as a possibility here is that what Moses may have seen maybe isn't just a one-to-one parallel of what the tabernacle ends up being, but he may have seen what Isaiah saw, what Ezekiel saw, what John the Apostle saw. So Hebrews 8, verse 5 says, the tabernacle things, they serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. And you can read in Exodus 24, when they enter the covenant relationship with God at Mount Sinai, that Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders go up partway onto the mountain. And it's an amazing passage. It says they saw God. They see some glorious things. It doesn't describe it in much detail. They see God, and it says they ate and drank, and God didn't strike them down. But they saw God in some sense. Maybe as a precursor of what these other visions would be that we see in the prophets. The tabernacle is a picture of God's heavenly throne. Was to help them to see that God was ruling in heaven. If you would go over to 1 Kings 8, where the temple has been built, this more permanent structure has been built. All kinds of finances and planning and effort has been put into building this. And Solomon ultimately says, God isn't really fitting in this box here that we've built. 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 27. But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built? Yet have regard to the prayer of your servant and to his plea. O Lord my God, listening to the cry and to the prayer that your servant prays before you this day, that your eyes may be open night and day toward this house, the place of which you have said, my name shall be there, that they may listen to the prayer that your servant offers toward this place, and listen to the plea of your servant and of your people when they pray toward this place, and listen in heaven, your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive. The temple is completed. In verse 10 of the same chapter, the cloud of God's presence filled the tabernacle, an indication that God had moved in. And Solomon's prayer expects people to pray with a recognition that God is actually enthroned in heaven. And this throne in heaven means that no matter what actually happens to this structure they've built, the Lord still reigns. God was not dependent on this place and on this building. And so you find in Daniel, when he's going to pray toward Jerusalem, there's no temple. And yet, he expects, and God does, hear from heaven and saves. In this prayer that Solomon offers, he speaks to that kind of thing. When people are taken captive toward the end of chapter 8, people are taken captive, and they pray. Here in heaven, answer the prayer. Let's go back over to Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah 6, verses 1 through 5. Think about the kinds of times Isaiah was living in. The kingdom is divided. There's hypocrisy and injustice and idolatry. Politically, the king has died in this year. But let's read chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. And the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet. And with two he flew. And one called another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. A time of national instability and religious hypocrisy. And Isaiah sees a vision of what the ark and of what the temple was already supposed to depict. Isaiah was going to go forward as a prophet. He receives the call, and he says, here I am, send me. But now, he has this powerful demonstration of who it is who is with him. Isaiah isn't a prophet just for some tiny nation in a world of empires. He is a prophet of the Almighty, Holy God, who rules the nations. Go ahead and turn over to Ezekiel. Ezekiel 1. Sometimes I don't say sometimes the applications outright. I was sitting on this for hours and thinking about this. Why don't you see the application? But I would say that when I say times of national and religious national instability and religious hypocrisy, there's probably application in our time, in this place, or not in this particular place, but in our time. And yet we know how much small we might feel in our little church, in our little community. The Lord is the one who's behind this work, and he was doing his work in his kingdom. All right, I stopped the talk. I didn't actually get to Ezekiel. Here we are, Ezekiel 1, and we're going to read this whole thing. Whenever I think of Ezekiel, I actually think of this group, because when I was here, I maybe eventually studied through Ezekiel quickly with Steve, but the thing I remember about being here with Ezekiel is that Emily was in a women's Bible study on Ezekiel, and get this, they were like studying the Bible at this women's Bible study, and studying Ezekiel, of all things. So that's like women's Bible studies should be, studying the Bible. And she knew Ezekiel well from that, and I had so little exposure, so I feel like I got to know the book of Ezekiel through your women's Bible study, so thank you. Let's go ahead and read Ezekiel 1, verses 1 through 28. In the 13th year, in the 4th month, on the 5th day of the month, as I was among the exiles by the Kebar Canal, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the 5th day of the month, it was the 5th year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the Kebar Canal, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. As I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually, and in the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal, and from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings and on their four sides, they had human hands, and the four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each of them went straight forward, without turning as they went. As for the likeness of their faces, each had a human face. The four had the face of a lion on the right side. The four had the face of an ox on the left side, and the four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces, and their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each of which touched the wing of another, while two covered their bodies. And each went straight forward wherever the spirit went would go. They went without turning as they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches moving to and fro among the living creatures. And the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning, and the living creatures darted to and fro like the appearance of a flash of lightning. A lot of brightness, a lot of different ways to say light. Verse 15, now as I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four of them. As for the appearance of the wheels, their construction, their appearance was like the gleaming of beryl. And the four had the same likeness, their appearance and construction, being as it were a wheel within a wheel. When they went in any of the four directions without turning as they went. and their rims were tall and awesome, and the rims of all four were full of eyes all around. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose. Wherever the spirit went, wanted to go, they went, and the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, these went, and when those stood, these stood, and when those rose from the earth, the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Over the heads of the living creatures, there was the likeness of an expanse, shining like awe-inspiring crystals, spread out above their heads. And under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight, one toward another, and each creature had two wings covering its body. And when they went, I heard the sound of their wings, like the sound of many waters, like the sound of the Almighty, a sound of tumult, like the sound of an army. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And above the expanse over their heads, there was a likeness of a throne, an appearance like sapphire. And seated above the likeness of a throne was a likeness with a human appearance. And upward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, gleaming metal like the appearance of fire enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire. And there was brightness around him like the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain. So was the appearance of the brightness all around. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Easy to get bogged down in the bizarre particulars there. But you keep moving and try to see the overall picture. A great cloud comes, just like a cloud filled the tabernacle, a cloud filled the temple to depict God's presence with them. So a cloud comes in this great vision. And similar to Isaiah, there are these heavenly creatures, these heavenly beings beneath God's throne or around God's throne. Winged figures like unto those at the Ark of the Covenant, not in all the details. Indescribable glory that he finds in all the ways available to them to describe. Utter shininess. God's throne. As in Isaiah, but with the wheels, because God is on the move. See, we have the living creatures, you have the glory, you have the cloud, all of that. God's presence, God's throne. But in Ezekiel, there's wheels. And there's quite an obsession with the wheels, with eyes all around that have the spirit within them. But when you keep reading Ezekiel, you find that the wheels are pretty important. Because God is on the move. Because Jerusalem is being destroyed, the temple's being destroyed, and God is leaving progressively throughout the book. He is leaving his people, leaving the temple because of the hypocrisy and the idolatry. But at the same time, you might have caught it when I said leaving his people, if you studied it. Well, where are his people? But in captivity, those who remain are in captivity in Babylon, and that is where the Lord was going. Where his mobile throne was moving, to be with his people through captivity. Ezekiel's vision here is also answered at the end of the book, in chapter 40 and following. God has moved out of the temple, and yet in the end of the book, the temple is restored. Or something like the temple, but greater. Some greater temple is promised. A promise of restoration. A greater temple to come. And so yeah, this sermon is a sermon about the book of Revelation. But all of this, all of these things, Isaiah, Ezekiel, even the literal thrones, and the kingdoms, the prayer of Solomon, the dedication of the temple, all those things help you, if those are part of your understanding of Scripture, help you when you come to the book of Revelation. It makes the book less intimidating and more wonderful, because then it's readable. Then there's something we can begin to grasp. A good friend of mine I got to know up in Milwaukee knew that there was all kinds of wrong-headed ideas that people pointed the book of Revelation for. And so what he was doing is he's just avoided touching Revelation because he didn't want to end up with any wrong ideas. Even getting him to read through Isaiah or something like that with me, he was very hesitant because he knew that how the prophets get abused to mean whatever people want them to mean. But I tried to urge him, okay, you don't want to think the wrong things about these things, but reading it isn't going to hurt. Reading it, just reading it, withholding maybe judgment about what all it means, but just reading it, familiarizing yourself with it, is only going to be a good thing. And so don't be afraid to touch it. Don't be so excited about Revelation that you neglect clearer scriptures and the Gospels and things like that. But don't be so afraid that you're not going to, don't want to touch it. Just familiarize yourself. Don't feel like you have to have it all figured out. Just spend time in those scriptures. Well, let's go ahead into Revelation 1, the initial scene here of the Son of Man. As John sees Jesus presented in glory here. Revelation 1, verses 9 through 20. I, John, your brother and partner in the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance that are in Jesus, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamum, to Thyatira, to Sardis, to Philadelphia, and to Laodicea. Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning I saw seven golden lampstands. In the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flaming fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined in a furnace, and his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand, he held seven stars, and from his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun, shining in full strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and Hades. Write, therefore, the things that you have seen, those that are and those that are to take place after this. For the mystery of the seven stars that you saw on my right hand and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. I want to note that at the beginning of most of these texts, there's been some background information that you might feel like we're just getting through to get to the vision. But some of that background information is the application that we're going to come back to somewhat. John is a partner in the tribulation. He's been on this island on account of the word of God. He's been exiled here. So that's the context in which God is bringing visions to his people here. The other thing I wanted to say here is if you ever had any questions about Christ in relationship to Jehovah and whether or not Jesus is Jehovah, whether or not Jesus is divine, this passage really does it all. In light of what we read about the one who shines, his glory is seen, you can read other things in here that pretty much say it outright. The things that you say about Jesus, you can't say about anyone unless they are God. It's glorious what we're seeing here. And it's, I don't think, what we should expect Jesus to literally look like in every detail. The sword coming out of his mouth, fiery eyes. But he is holy. He's glorified. He's majestic. His fiery eyes see, there's nothing hidden. His word is a sword bringing justice and deliverance. But I would say as you touch on something like the book of Revelation, don't seek to reduce each image to just come away with a meaning so that you could rewrite the book of Revelation and substitute all the words for what they really mean. I don't think it's allegory to that extent. We are shown power and glory, and we should be left wondering at his majesty, even when we don't pick up on every detail and what it may or may not mean. The risen Lord has a message for these churches in what is now modern-day Turkey. These are real churches in the same world that we're in. Real churches with temptation and suffering like real Christians might face today, if not worse. And Jesus then begins to address these churches in chapters 2 and 3. Revelation is not fantasy. It's not fiction. It's not just fireworks. It's meaningful and practical for Christians facing real temptations, real persecution, real false teaching. If it's what God chose to give them in their time of need, then it's something that we can receive in our time of need, that we need throughout Christians throughout the centuries. And so if you're in ancient Laodicea, what is it you think Christians need in the Roman world? There's all kinds of things Christians might seek. We've got all kinds of problems, all kinds of threats, all kinds of dangers. So what is it we need? Would you have imagined that what you needed was the book of Revelation? Would that be the answer? What do you hope for? What do you pray for? God gives them this, and the basic message is the Lord reigns. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord is enthroned in heaven. And so whatever we think we need, and whatever allegiances and deals we make to secure ourselves, God is telling us we need this message. The Lord's throne is secure. There's no hand-wringing necessary. But how could a book of visions help us deal with reality? Well, the visions, the symbols, are not just symbols. They're not just exciting or neat to think about. God uses symbols that tell the truth. And we don't see the full truth on earth right now. And so in this book, God is giving to Christians what we need to endure. Let's go ahead and read chapter 4. And if you're expecting a full exposition of that, it's not what I was intending. I mostly, in this lesson, wanted us to be impressed with the fact that our Lord reigns and to adore him for that. But let's read Revelation 4, and we'll discuss it just a little while here. After this I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice, which I had heard speaking to me like a trumpet, said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne stood in heaven with one seated on the throne. He who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian, and around the throne was a rainbow that had the appearance of an emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones were 24 elders, clothed in white garments, with golden crowns on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder, and before the throne were burning 7 torches of fire, which are the 7 spirits of God. And before the throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass, like crystal. And around the throne, on each side of the throne, are 4 living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with the face of a man, and the fourth living creature like an eagle in flight. And the 4 living creatures, each of them with 6 wings, are full of eyes all around and within. Day and night they never cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." Whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who is seated on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever. They cast their crowns before the throne, saying, "Worthy are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created." For John and for us, God merges previous heavenly temple throne scenes into one. There's the heavenly strange creatures with eyes all around, thinking of Ezekiel. This takes us again back to the cherubim affixed to the ark. Other ancient rulers covered their throne rooms with fanciful images. If you go to Chicago, you can go to the Oriental Institute. They've renamed it now. I don't remember what the name is now. There's a museum at the University of Chicago that has an ancient throne scene from Assyria. Massive, fantastic creatures. But all those are attempts at communicating grandeur. John gets to peel back and see the reality that is yet unseen for us, of a throne scene that outdoes them all. And that's true and real. And it's in heaven over all creation. Six wings the creatures have, saying, "Holy, holy, holy." Again, bringing in what we saw in Isaiah. And what's the point? That's the same basic point we've been saying again and again. The point, though, confirmed by the Messiah who came, died, and rose again. The Lord is on his throne. As you read the book of Revelation, I hope, just prepares you for what's coming. What is God's decree going to be? What's going to happen next? And in chapter 5 is going to build the suspense even more when there's some revelation to be seen, but it's sealed. No one is able to open it. And then the lamb appears who can open it. And that thrusts you forward into the book to say, what is God's decree? The one who rules, the one who reigns, what is his decree for us? As final thoughts from all of this, I want to just take, again, the context of some of these people, just to think about what those visions would have meant to them. Just briefly here, in Solomon's prayer, he wanted the people to pray to God on his throne in heaven. Sadly, of course, Solomon built shrines for his wives for other gods. And he wasn't faithful to what he was doing with the temple. But he wanted, ultimately, in this prayer, the ideal he pointed to is that people would pray to God, not see him as trapped in this box, always there whether or not we sought him or not, but he wanted us to see God on his throne in heaven and trust that he would rescue those who took refuge in him. And we need to, like Isaiah, take heart that no matter what shakes your world now, your God reigns. No matter what people with power over your life might do, the Lord is in his holy temple. Sometimes in the current kind of culture war arena, political arena we can be in, people absolutize themselves, and I'm borrowing that from Richard Bauckham, who writes on Revelation, but they make themselves out to be what you need because of what's at stake. Christians need this guy. They need this movement, or else what's going to happen? Where's our standing in the public square going to be if we don't put in our lot? Don't run like a bird to your mountain. Don't flee like a bird to your mountain. The Lord is in his holy temple. Don't take whatever refuge comes saying that they're a refuge for you. Isaiah needed to remember, and he as a prophet was going to remind the people, don't look to the nations around you. Don't look to the gods around you. Look to the Lord. And Ezekiel, like Ezekiel, we need to remember and remind each other that they don't have to be afraid. To remind each other that God will fulfill his promises to dwell with us again. I didn't write down the lyrics here, but if you don't know the song, if you want to take note of Is He Worthy, and you can find Praise and Harmony has an a cappella version of this song. Is He Worthy is a song by Andrew Peterson, a hymn turned into a hymn. But I find it very helpful to think about a lot of these things and the themes in Revelation. The Lord intends to dwell with us again. His promise is not complete. That is what he has promised, and Jesus has been that guarantee. And then again, like John, exiled in Patmos, like your fellow Christian there, facing persecution in the first century, let the reality of God's throne in heaven empower you to hold to the truth, face the trials that are before you, and be faithful even to death. Whatever we face, Though the wrong seems off so strong, God is the ruler yet. I want to read Psalm 11 one more time to close. And I hope this psalm does something for you and is reminding all of these things, reminding you of all these things, of this now but not yet situation we're in. Though it may not look like it, God is on his throne. Let's read Psalm 11. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They have fitted their arrow to the string to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked. Fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his faith, for his face. The Psalms aren't just sweet sentiments. And Revelation isn't just for nerdy Bible students. It is for the suffering Christian who needs to seek the Lord as his refuge. It's for the person who doesn't see the promises of God in their fruition and needs to remember that God has given Christ as the first fruits. He is risen from the dead, and he is coming back to save and to judge finally. Let's go ahead and stand and sing.